Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhan, host of our Monday podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia. Happy New Year. How are you?
Hello, Yu Yun. Happy New Year.
We're also glad to have with us today Jürgen Mattes, Head of International Economic Policy, Financial and Real Estate Market Research Unit at the German Economic Institute. Nice to meet you, Jürgen. Happy New Year and welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Yeah, hi to both of you and Happy New Year as well.
Let's directly dive into the topic. Today we want to talk about the yuan under appreciation. So there's been a growing sense in Europe that competition with China has fundamentally changed in recent years, particularly because of concerns about overcapacity. Alicia, could you start by giving us an overview of China's trade surplus with the EU and why it has become such a focal point of the debate?
Our trade deficit with China is kind of new. If you think about it as with a long-term perspective, we used to have a rather trade balance with China for many years. It was really the post-pandemic world that changed this. So we started to import a lot from China during the pandemic. And all of those things that were related to the pandemic at the beginning, you know, became more general, if you want, or more value-added, I would say. First, in new sectors like green tech, but also in sectors where Europe had dominated global markets for a long time. If you think about chemicals or dominate or be one of the big players, chemicals, autos, all of this became, you know, a double directional thing. So with China exporting to Europe, Europe exporting to China, but especially elsewhere, and competing in those third markets. So in a way, I would say that although Europe has remained, of course, excluding the terrible year after the invasion of Ukraine, where, you know, Europe had to deal with much a higher cost of import of oil, where the trade surplus shrunk to, I believe, a small deficit. But point is, we're back to a surplus, not as big as before. But the missing link there is China. This at the peak, 400 billion is a lot of, you know, huge deficit with China that in a way is strange because we are back to surplus, but which would be much bigger without China. Yeah. But we didn't go back to a balance with China, but a big, big deficit. So are we competitive with everybody but China? I mean, what's the story there? It's a very strange thing to explain why we have such a big deficit with China. Some countries, say Vietnam, they have deficits because they are like in this game of, you know, bilateral deficit with China, but then the re-export to the US. We're not in that game. So it's very hard to explain what's happening in Europe. That's why we invited Jürgen, and I'm going to stop right here because he knows so much more than me.
Great. Thanks so much for setting the scene for us. So Jürgen, let me come to you. In your paper, what is the central problem you address when it talks about, you know, this cost advantages for China? And why is this debate especially relevant right now for Europe and Germany?
Yeah, thanks for having me. That's a great opportunity. Yeah, I think maybe my paper can help a bit in explaining what Alicia has just pointed out about this strange thing of having a huge trade deficit with China and at the same time a trade surplus with most of the other countries. Well, China has huge cost advantages compared to us. Some are because of China becomes better, is more innovative, especially in renewables, as Alicia has pointed out. But we also see at least two major reasons for unfair cost advantages. And these are subsidies in China of the state and the system of industrial policy. Studies show that they are large and pervasive. We know this, and we will only slightly, maybe on the side, talk about these issues. But a very underrated factor until recently has been topic of the yuan and the valuation of the yuan. And in my view, and the paper shows it, the yuan is significantly undervalued. So China is artificially cheaper than it should be. And this also relates back to some extent to the corona pandemic, as Alicia has pointed out. So let's look a bit deeper into these cost disadvantages that we have, because they are really highly relevant. We did a survey of German firms last year, or in 2024, and basically half of industrial firms with China competition in their market said Chinese competitors are in their markets with prices that are more than 30% below their prices. And we hear anecdotal evidence of 40, 50, or even more percentage that Chinese competitors are much cheaper. And the question is, can this be only due to efficiency and innovation, or are there unfair pieces as well? And it's relevant for us because we also had half of these industrial firms with China competition saying, due to China, or as a consequence of China competition, we share jobs here in Germany. And so German trade deficit with China will be in the area of 90 billion in 2025. This is really huge, has never been as huge as that. And so if you have such a huge deficit, the question is, where does it come from? And the paper answers this in basically two steps. And I will first point out the first step. This is the extent of our cost disadvantage that is to some extent related to the currency issue.
Yeah, and then what about the unfair part that you mentioned?
And the second part will be, is it unfair? Is it a real undervaluation? Is this currency manipulation? So let's come to the first step. Well, how does this cost disadvantage that we have and the huge cost advantages that China have came about? Well, when we compare early 2020, so before the corona pandemic, to mid of 2025, as the study does, we see that producer prices in the euro area have risen by a very, very high amount, an exceptionally high amount. They were higher by about 50% in 2023 and came down a bit, and they are now still 35% higher than they were in early 2020, pre-COVID. The producer price inflation was much higher than consumer price inflation. And what were the reasons for this? Well, most of this cost surge came in 2021. And what was happening in 2021? It was the supply chain restrictions that we saw due to the COVID lockdowns and the global logistic problems. Input prices rose a lot, import prices rose a lot. And after that, in 2022, there came the energy price rises due to the Russian war of aggression and the gas embargo. So there were two external reasons, the supply chain restrictions and the supply chains and the energy crisis. And these were huge price shocks that made us much more expensive. Looking at China and the producer prices in, development in China, there was a small rise over time, but mid-2020, basically the PPI, so the producer price index in China, was pretty much the same level as then it was in early 2020. So basically no constant or longer-term price rise. So what happened to the exchange rate between the yuan and the euro? Basically nothing. More depreciation happened instead of an appreciation. So, and when you then take all this together and look at a real exchange rate, so basically looking at the nominal exchange rate and then also looking at the cost divergence that came about, you come to an appreciation of the euro compared to the yuan of more than 40%. And this is really huge. Again, comparing January 2020 to mid of 2025. And this is a huge, huge cost disadvantage. And well, it plays out because we see what we would in theory see from economics. When you look at economic theory, if you have such an a undervalued currency and such a lack of appreciation, at the same time when these cost divergence happen, you will have a trade deficit and a rising trade deficit. And indeed, comparing to 2020, the trade deficit of the euro area with China doubled, as Alicia also had pointed out before, and the trade deficit of Germany with China rose even more. So basically, what we see is, this is basically the end of the first point. No matter whether this is unfair or fair, We have this huge cost disadvantages, and they contribute to our industry crisis. They contribute to the shedding of jobs that we see in German and European industry. They contribute to a hollowing out of our industry. And then the next question would indeed be, is this unfair or is it a normal development? And when you look at this question, and the paper does it as well, you get indications that it is an undervaluation. So that basically you have some degree of unfairness, and that comes from currency manipulation or comes from the way China manages its currency. So how can you argue this? Basically, going back to economic theory, when you have such a huge appreciation in real terms, as I pointed out, so cost divergence and no reaction of the exchange rate, well, as I said, it's natural that you have a higher trade deficit. What does a higher trade deficit mean? It means basically we import much more from China. So we bring on the, when you look now on the foreign exchange market, we basically bring euro to buy yuan on the market. And what happens on a, if we had a market-based flexible exchange rate, if you bring something to buy another thing, the other thing becomes more expensive because you have more demand for yuan. Yuan price should have risen, but it didn't. So when you then look at basically have this view of the foreign exchange rate market, you can say, or you could say, okay, goods trade is not the only thing that happens on the exchange rate markets. You have also other factors that come into play. And indeed, we have services trade. We have profits coming from foreign direct investment that European firms have in China, and we also have capital flows. But even if you take all these further elements together and look at the basically balance of payments that takes all these different issues together, you still see a much higher demand for yuan in euro when you compare 2020 to and 2021 to the two following or the three following years, so 2022 to 2024. In 2022 and up to 2024, the demand for yuan was much higher, but there was no reaction of the bilateral exchange rate. And I see this as a clear indication of currency manipulation. China basically must have bought up the surplus supply of euros to keep the exchange rate stable. We should see this in rising currency reserves in euro in China. But China doesn't have transparency here.
Thanks very much for the detailed explanation, Jürgen. Alicia, does this answer your question? And what's your take on this assessment? So, when European firms say they cannot compete with Chinese prices, how much of this is normal global competition, and how much reflects deeper structural differences between economic systems?
So yeah, I quite agree, but I'd like to add a little bit more on, you know, the two potential stories. So the Chinese stories, we're more competitive and we don't basically need anything from you because we can do it ourselves now. That's the story. There's some truth in that, in the sense that China has moved so much so fast up the ladder, and it has pursued self-reliance policies to the level of not needing many of the goods that it would have imported otherwise. Fair or unfair is, in a way, irrelevant. But, you know, we're not here. I mean, this is not about values, or this is about economics. The reality is that China has pursued self-reliance policies. Europe hasn't. And therefore, China has substituted through also innovation and industrial policy, the good and the bad, if you want. But never mind, it has substituted a lot of imports from Europe. And why from Europe? Because China has emulated, if you want, Europe's industrial basket, if you want. Very, very similar to Europe, much more similar than to the US. So that's another reason. The US is also an exporter of oil or, you know, shale gas. We're not. So because of that, it's close. I mean, the impact is bigger on Europe because it's more similar to us. So that is the kind of the, you could measure it in terms of, you know, value added. We have those data. China moving up the ladder in supply chains, value added in exports, and you can see that, but not to the extent of getting to a deficit of 400 billion. The rest is price competitiveness. whether the yuan should be at 7 or 3, some people say even 3 against the dollar, obviously, is not, I mean, I can't really judge that. China is no longer accumulating reserves, so one could argue maybe it's market-based. No, I don't think it's so market-based, frankly. But the point is that they, as an economist, there's a disconnect. Yeah, you're moving up the ladder. You're becoming more productive and your exchange rate doesn't move. Well, if it doesn't move, maybe it's lack of trust in your currency. Yeah, but if you want to believe it's market-based. But certainly it's not the level you should have for your competitiveness. That's the point. That's basically the point. On top of that, when you become more productive and you produce, your basket is more sophisticated. Your prices should be higher because you're becoming more sophisticated. Like, look how expensive the US is. I mean, like, no, China is more sophisticated, but cheaper. I mean, how can you explain that? So, you know, the deflationary pressures in China come, this is very obvious and everybody knows, from the fact that the domestic demand is weak. And therefore, there is this, for China to grow, China continues to invest. Fixed asset investment in manufacturing still grows above GDP growth. So you, there you go. I mean, it's simple. You invest more than you need. Your only answer is the rest of the world. Even with the rest of the world buying as much as for you to accumulate a trillion in a trade surplus, not enough. You still have overcapacity. And therefore, that pushes prices down, which makes you more competitive so that you can export more. I mean, that's the story. So nobody denies China's moving up the ladder. It's just that that is inconsistent. Not unfair, fair, no. Inconsistent with prices that actually fall. That can happen anywhere for very long. So, you know, and people compare this with Japan, but let's bear in mind that it's quite different because Japan's deflation happened at the end of the bubble and Japan's biggest export push happened at the beginning of the bubble. Japan did not have negative prices at the beginning of the bubble when it was exporting the world. Yeah. And no, it didn't have deflation. It's China that is incomprehensible, if you ask me, because if you are becoming so productive, so competitive, you should not need to deflate. You don't need it. You are already competitive. So, you know, there is something really strange. I wouldn't call it unfair. But that strange thing is very costly for Europe. In that regard, we can call it unfair from our perspective. You know, wow, I mean, this is big for Europe. But the adjective doesn't matter, Yuyun. Or, you know, it doesn't matter. The point for Europe is this very incomprehensible reality is hurting Europe. Thus, Europe needs to react. If China believes this is normal, Europe will have to react anyway. It doesn't matter what, you know, how we label it. The reality is that this is really hurting Europe. And part of that is not explained by economic fundamentals. It is just not possible to explain it. Therefore, Europe will have to use non-market, if you want, instruments, because the market instruments are not going to happen. They're not happening. And that brings us to what to do about this.
Thanks for that, Alicia. And I really agree with you. This is not a podcast to judge about value. But then here we're talking about what impact this has been to Europe and realistically, what policy options does Europe have to address this imbalance? And are exchange rate related response feasible? Or does this push the EU more toward trade defense instruments and industrial policy? I'll start with you, Jürgen, because you already mentioned some of the options in your paper.
I agree with Alicia that this hardly or difficult to explain phenomenon is a real problem for us. But I think it would make it easier for us to say to also still talk a bit about the question of whether it's unfair or not. And when you talk about this, you might not also look at whether the bilateral relationship between euro and the yuan that I looked at in my paper is relevant, but you can also look at the overall trade surplus that China has with the world. And this has in merchandise trade, this is now more than $1 trillion US dollars. And this is also an indication that the exchange rate of China should appreciate. Even the IMF now came out to say we need more exchange rate flexibility. So I think, well, whatever China does, they might do it if it's successful for them. But if what they are doing has negative spillovers to us, then it will become a problem to us. And the lack of the appreciation of the yuan is such a problem. And well, Alicia, you said we don't see a rise in the currency reserves of China. Yeah, this is true for the official reserves. But I think Brad Setzer from the Council of Foreign Relations points out that that China started to hide currency reserves in the state banking system for years. So probably a lot of happens on the exchange rate market that we don't really see, because if you were able to point off to this exchange rate appreciation by looking at the rising currency reserves in euro, you would have a clear proof, and China hides this proof. So basically, coming to policy options, well, the first best policy option would be just for China to significantly appreciate its currency. This is, I think, pretty clear. And Alicia, you said probably a very huge rise of the currency would be appropriate. And if you hear about companies here in Europe saying, well, so often China even undercuts their costs, not only their prices, their costs by 30% or something, this cannot be based on a normal development. And as you said, it would be very strange if this would be normal economics. So what can we do? Depreciating the euro would be only theoretical option, because, well, the ECB would be in the game. ECB is independent, so it's a difficult avenue to go. In my view, we should look maybe not so much for non-price instruments, but we have trade policy instruments. We have anti-dumping and anti-subsidy instruments, so trade defense instruments, and undervaluation is not perfectly covered by the laws that underlie these trade defense instruments. But, well, we should have smart trade lawyers that look for ways to still account for undervaluation of the yuan, because this should enable us to set tariffs higher if we have countervailing duties. Basically, in the BEV case, if you also factored in the undervaluation, probably the tariffs should be even higher than they are. And the other thing is, well, usually when we look at EU production that comes under pressure, and we look for subsidies in China, we should do this. But we would usually look to direct subsidies or indirect subsidies, as was done in the BEV case for the electric vehicles that were levied in the end of 2024. But the exchange rate basically is a subsidy that is relevant for all goods that we import from China. And well, when we have goods that we don't produce here, well, that's nice. We can buy them more cheaply. But if we have goods that we do produce here and that come under this pressure, the undervaluation is a reason for having an anti-subsidy case, because an undervaluation is basically a subsidy, and the US has already tried to put this into an anti and a countervailing duty case, basically saying when you export, it was a case against Vietnam, as a Vietnam exporter, and you have an undervalued currency, you receive more of your own currency when you trade in dollar, and this amount that you receive more due to the wrong value of your currency can be deemed a subsidy. So there would be avenues to go this way. And on top of this, we should also bring a case to the WTO saying, with this huge trade deficit of us, with this huge trade surplus of China with the world, basically, we see a nullification and an impairment of our benefits that the WTO should convey. So it would be a very general case. It would take years, but it would basically flank and give a cover for our much stronger use of trade defense instruments. So this would be my way to go. I would be more critical of going with non-price instruments.
Alicia, do you think China will appreciate yuan, and what other policy options do you see there?
China has actually allowed for some recent appreciation, so it touched, it went below seven. There's been some appreciation against the dollar, which actually has appreciated after the Venezuelan event. So yes, there is a hint that they know this is a problem, you know. But we're talking about a massive appreciation here that is needed because prices are still negative. I actually estimated, Jürgen, how much of this 40%? I had 38 or something, but more or less the same number as you, using producer prices. I separated the price effect and the exchange rate effect. Price effect is two-thirds. So, if you want to solve this problem only with a nominal exchange rate, good luck. It has to go to maybe four or, I mean, we're talking peanuts here. I mean, what's happening in the market is peanuts compared to what is needed. So, because the deflationary pressures are not going to stop anytime soon, China is trying anti-involution measures. They're not working. There's huge overcapacity. Forget about prices becoming very positive, producer prices, anytime soon. Therefore, the exchange rate has to overreact. It's very hard for China to do it.
I know, but and China is I think much afraid of appreciation because they remember what happened in the 1980s to Japan with this huge Plaza Accord appreciation that allegedly contributed to the demise of the Japanese economy afterwards. You can debate this, but I don't think it's very likely that China will move significantly on the exchange rate, even though they should, because, well, just to remember what happened in the 1980s here in Europe. We had an exchange rate system and we had a development where usually in Germany prices rose little, in Italy and Spain and other countries prices rose much more. So then we had this exchange rate system and pressure built because Spain and the southern European countries ran into trade deficits, and we had huge movement or like basically pressure on the exchange rate market. In the end, the German D-mark had to appreciate to balance out these effects. And this would be a we had a kind of semi-fixed exchange rate system then, but at some stages were huge appreciations of the German mark, of the Dutch gulden and others. So it is to some extent normal to have these even huge appreciations if you stop your currency or if you prevent your currency from reacting flexible. And this is just what China is doing. So again, on a theoretical basis, it would be the best option for China to really do a huge appreciation, as they probably won't. We have to react, and we have to react strongly on the trade policy side. And well, we see whether there's some preparedness in this, but I read that also the European Chamber of Commerce in China and Jens Eskelund pointed out that they see a problem there. So in my view, pressure is building, and Brad Setzer also calculated that you need an appreciation of about at least 30%. So a huge step and not these kind of small steps that China currently allows.
Yeah, last year Alicia also wrote a paper according to the survey results from the European Chamber of Commerce in China, talking about European business confidence in doing business in China. So we will put the link there in the show notes, and also, of course, Jürgen's paper. So then, for audience who are interested, you can read the papers in detail. As you said correctly, Jürgen, that Europe needs to react, and Europe needs to react fast. But how do we keep this balance? What are the biggest risks if Europe choose not to react? And if conversely, what are the dangers of reacting too aggressively?
Okay, difficult question and important question, obviously. We haven't yet talked about the policy reaction that we need here. So we need to raise our competitiveness. We have to bring down energy costs to some extent. We have to stop labor costs from rising further. We have to bring down bureaucracy costs. Yes, this is obviously for us the first best option to do. But with such a huge cost disadvantage, this will not suffice at all. So we can do a bit, but it's not realistic to compensate a 40% cost increase compared to China. This undervaluation of the yuan is just too large. So again, we have to react. And if we don't react, basically we will see a hollowing out of our industry. We hear a lot from German automotive suppliers, from machinery firms in Germany, that their buyers that used to be in Europe, that their customers basically no longer source from them, but they increasingly source from China. So we really see, and this is in the heart of the German managed machinery sector and the automotive sector. So we see this hollowing out. And what is also coming on this, we want to become less dependent on the import side from China. So we want to de-risk, at least in those areas where we highly and critically dependent on China. With China being so cheap, this is basically impossible. So this is another reason for why we have to act, because if we don't, it will be so very difficult to do this de-risking. And yeah, this will, if we use trade policy in the way that I pointed out, this will potentially and pretty likely lead to some retaliation from China. But we just cannot accept these huge disadvantages that come to us. Basically, from our perspective, it is just, or to, coming back to my paper, this 50% or this very huge rise of the producer prices that came due to the supply chain restrictions were a really external, exceptional effect. And if the exchange rate relation doesn't, or exchange rate doesn't react to this, we have to put up our defenses here and try to do this in a way that does not turn us into protectionists, but trying to equalize and countervail the unfair elements of Chinese price advantages. They are difficult to pin down, yes, but well, we also must be aware, if we open the Pandora box of using trade policy more intensively, the danger obviously is that this can also be misused, and we should be pretty careful in trying to prevent this.
Thanks very much, Alicia.
Yeah, quickly, but hopefully with a bang. I don't think we have the instruments to deal with this. I'm sorry. Our toolkit deals with specific cases of whether it's anti-subsidy or, subsidies or dumping. But this is across the board. These are producer prices. They affect every product. So if we wait for, I don't know, 18 months for every single investigation, we'll never get there. We don't have the instruments. This is the key message for the last part. If anybody gets to the end of our podcast, I just want them to know. And that's how we can guess if they actually listen to it. We don't have the instruments. And worse than that, I was actually thinking of whether we could emulate the US, an instrument that I used to hate for so long, this, currency manipulation instrument by the US Treasury. But that's nominal exchange rate. Even that one doesn't work because two-thirds are coming from negative prices. Yeah, so what do we do? So I guess we would have to go across the board, meaning monitoring producer prices and basically thinking of a mechanism on the real bilateral exchange rate. We've never heard of this. This is how bad it is that we're not even discussing it. We've never heard of such instrument, and we're supposed to find something of this sort. So it is not only urgent, it's difficult. Because we can't use even the US instruments for this matter.
If we talk about local content restrictions that are going to come with the Industrial Accelerator Act in Europe and with some other instruments, this would be the wrong way to go, in my view, because this opens the Pandora box towards protectionism even more. And it will have huge disadvantages with a huge monster of bureaucracy. My point is, we have a problem of unfair cost advantages. We basically have and a big basically have instruments that should be able to address these distortions with the countervailing subsidies, anti-dumping. The way the rules are currently written doesn't allow us to do what we should do or what we needed to do. So if we are prepared, and I also have to say, if we go for local content and we do it on a broad basis, this will very broadly break WTO rules. So if we are, if policymakers are prepared to break WTO rules, then they better go along the way that has been laid out by the WTO. And we don't then basically, we don't, we, or to put it in a metaphor would be, we continue to go along WTO roads, but we don't adhere to every sign on the, or traffic sign on the side of the road. So when you talk about a undervaluation, you should talk about a real undervaluation. So you, this would bring in your price effects that you mentioned, and I agree that basically this two-thirds, one-third relationship is probably true. So you can measure the extent of undervaluation, and then you would put levies, countervailing levies on the on these. The problem would be to say, well, this subsidy that an exporter gets is not specific in a narrow sense. Yes, okay, because if you trade in equities or whatever with the dollar, you also if you don't trade with goods, you trade with you might trade with services or you might trade with some other things with the US market, then all these people that have these international transactions would get the subsidy. So it's not specific to exporters. Okay, but it's specific to all those who trade in dollar. And all those who do not trade in dollar.
I lost you on this very last part, but I want to say something because I don't want to be misinterpreted because you jumped on this idea of the local content. I'm not proposing local content for a very simple reason. First, because I do believe that if we do not become more competitive, no matter what we do, it won't help. I mean, it's just not. So local content will not make us more competitive. That's why I'm not into the local content. But also because it is only China that has negative producer prices, you know, not Japan, by the way, basically higher inflation than Europe. So the rest of the world should not pay the price of this. We should import from other parts of the world. We don't need to impose local content, but we should target unwarranted. I don't want to say unfair, but you said unfair. Fine. Unwarranted, whatever, something more neutral. Under real appreciation of a currency, because that kills our market. It's very simple. It's a survival tool. Let's call it survival tool, you know, whatever. But is a survival tool WTO compliant? What a question. We are in survival mode, you know? I mean, whoever comes to me with, is it WTO compliant? Sorry, I'm moving to a different room because I can't take it. You know what I mean? Like, we're talking about major distortion. How can I imagine? Yeah, I'm swimming in a major distortion and I'm there trying to use a tiny needle for every single drop of water where I mean, like, come on, that's the anti-dumping we're trying to consider. So we need an instrument. We can, if you want to mask it into WTO compliance thing, go to a very broad definition of subsidy. And yes, let China come to WTO. Sure. Queue, because there's thousands of cases waiting to, you know, like, come on. I mean, what kind of reason is this? Nobody is solving anything at the WTO now. We're not even there in solving a survival problem because of something that is not working. I mean, this is how religious we are on the WTO. We want something that solves a real problem for us, which is this underappreciated currency and prices together, real exchange rate. We do not want to close our markets. We can still, you know, trade with the whole world. I just want to say, we cannot solve this with, dumping on pork, which is what China, I mean, no, on a specific type of pork. I mean, we'll never get there, for God's sake, you know. We need something bigger. That's what I'm saying. If we want to call it anti-dumping, let's call it anti-dumping. I couldn't care less. I just want something broader. And that does not Close our market. I agree with you. No domestic content. That is not what we need.
Yeah, so we're basically on the same page. We need much broader trade defense instruments and have to be smart and pragmatic in bringing them. And this will not always, we could try to stay within WTO rules as far as it goes. But if it doesn't go, then we have to go beyond. And we kind of at the same time bring a big case to the WTO and say, under these conditions, it is just no longer fair. It is we don't get our benefits, and then this case will be there for years, but it will give us cover to break WTO also in certain respects in order to get these trade defense instruments broader, because we only have one problem, and this problem is China, and the problem is the unfair or the distortions that we have in the game. And so we have instruments that can tackle these. They have to become broader, and we have to become more ingenious in trying to get them broad.
So basically, I fully agree, and I would say something to end. What about CBAM? How many people think CBAM is not WTO compliant and we don't seem to care? Yeah? I mean, like, why don't we behave CBAM-ly? That's the way I would behave. It looks like it complies, even if everybody disagrees, because I love CBAM. I push for it. What about that one? You know, like a CBAMizing instrument on the real ex bilateral exchange rate. What about that? So I leave it there, but I'm just saying we need to really move out of the tiny instrument, sorry to say, we can't solve this problem. It's too urgent, too big, too important.
We are going to have an episode talking about CBAM for our Bruegel podcast, so listeners can stay tuned for that. And let's mark this the end of our conversation. And thank you very much, Jürgen and Alicia, for joining this interesting conversation. I am Yuyun Zhan. I'm with Alicia Garcia Herrero from Bruegel and Jürgen Mattes at the German Economic Institute. And for listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with link in the show notes. As our first China episode of the year, we wish you a very happy new year, and we're going to continue to bring you more updates about China's economy in 2026. So until next time, bye bye.